Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome everyone to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. It is October 4th, 2017. I am Chris Martinson. Today's podcast, it's about what we can do right now to begin setting things right. I know the news is full of horror and betrayal, and sometimes it seems like there's not much to be hopeful about or for, but my work regularly exposes me to the people who are doing things that are clearly beneficial, clearly helpful. As Adam and I wrote in the book Prosper, one of the most destructive narratives out there is that humans are just destructive. More of us simply means more destruction. More plastic in the oceans, more ecological destruction, more species lost, more beauty lost, more hate in the world. That's the story. But as with all narratives, that one draws its energy from the amount of belief people invest in it. There's another narrative too, one that instead says that we humans can be incredible agents of positive change and regeneration. That we can put our amazing minds and hearts towards increasing abundance in being fair and loving and equitable. And that narrative too draws its power from how many people believe in it. One of the favorite quotes I've got that I use in my seminars from Gandhi, he said, "Your beliefs become your thoughts become your words become your actions become your habits become your values become your destiny." So in short, it is well past time that we shift our beliefs away from the broken narrative of destructive and extractive consumption and towards our rightful destiny as powerful agents of creativity and regeneration. So today, we're going to be talking with Connor Stedman about how certain farming practices can be introduced that will, in one fell swoop, park gigatons of carbon in the soil, rebuild soil health and complexity, and revitalize, hopefully, the nutrient density of the foods that we eat. Connor's a field ecologist, agroforestry specialist, and educator based in Western New England and in the Hudson Valley specifically. He holds an MS in ecological planning from the University of Vermont. He is a lead organizer of the internationally recognized Carbon Farming Course. Connor offers consulting and design for multi-productive forest management at Appleseed Permaculture, including silvopasture, forest understory crops, productive buffers, and wildlife habitat. He's also one of the smartest people I know. Connor, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Chris. You're much too kind.
Well, you and I go back a bit. We've known each other for a ways. We've both gone and done what we're doing in the world. I'm so thrilled to have you on the program to find out what you've been up to and help expose people to what I think is an actual solution or approach we can and should be taking at this time. So thank you so much for being here with us today.
Real pleasure to be here. Happy to have the conversation.
Well, let me start here. We're going to be talking about something called carbon farming. What exactly is that?
Okay, so I think we have to talk a little bit about the basics of what climate change is and what's driving climate change in order to talk about carbon farming. And I assume your listeners are pretty familiar with that. But just to review, for the last few million years of the Earth's history, when there's been this cycle of glaciers advancing and receding in the Northern Hemisphere, the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has gone between about 180 parts per million and 280 parts per million. And that is that's the band in which all of human history has happened up until the last 200 or 300 years. And now the concentration of carbon dioxide is about 407 parts per million, almost 50% higher than the upper end of that historical normal. And carbon dioxide is one of a number of greenhouse gases that hold heat in the Earth's atmosphere rather than it being fully reflected back out into space. So the international climate science community has estimated, based on a lot of research and number crunching and thought about the weather and climate implications of global warming, that in order to keep, well, so let me say this. The we're already seeing some really catastrophic outcomes from climate change all around the world, from more frequent and more intense hurricanes in the Atlantic to sea level rise with whole nations losing their land and homes, to the very rapid warming of the Arctic and the displacement of people from there, to the bleaching and die-off of coral reefs because of increased temperature and ocean acidity, and a lot of other things we could talk about. And the hard news and big challenge of our lifetimes and beyond is that the worst is yet to come of those impacts on the current trajectory we're on of greenhouse gas emissions. And so the trajectory we're on is towards a planet that is significantly less livable than the one we have now for the large majority of people on the planet. And if we were to have the fullest, fastest possible decarbonization of the current world economy, far beyond what has, you know, so far been socially and politically viable, and that would be a good thing to do. That would be of huge value for the people living now and the people to come after us. We would still be facing a future of increasingly severe climate disruption for people all over the world, because in order to stave off some of the most extreme outcomes and impacts of climate change, the best thinking of the climate science community is that average global warming would need to be held to around 2 degrees Celsius. Now, because of the lag time between when emissions are released and when they affect warming in the atmosphere, although we're at 407 parts per million now, we've only experienced average warming of about 1.3 degrees Celsius so far. So even if we were to go down to global net zero emissions tomorrow, which would be an amazing miracle, we would still be far over the 350 parts per million that climate scientists believe is needed to avoid the most catastrophic things that may be ahead. So the emissions reduction work, which is the focus of most of the work in the last 20 or 30 years on addressing climate change, that was the focus of the International Paris Climate Agreement. That's the focus of regulating auto emissions and power plant emissions in the US. And other countries in the world, as the focus of shifting to renewable energy sources. Emissions reduction is going to have to be paired with significant carbon sequestration as well. And at the same time, carbon sequestration won't be successful without emissions reduction, because if we sequester huge amounts of carbon, we're still adding a net about 5 billion tons of carbon per year to the atmosphere. And to give you an image of the numbers involved here, to get down from 407 parts per million to 350 parts per million, we would have to remove at least 130 billion tons of carbon from the atmosphere and put it somewhere, plus zero net emissions beyond that. And because going to zero net emissions globally is not what's, you know, sadly, unfortunately, is not what's going to happen. We're gonna have to take out quite a bit more than 130 billion tons. Most people are estimating between, even with rapid decarbonization, between 200 and 250 billion tons of carbon are gonna have to be stored. And often when you read in the news about carbon sequestration, the main way it's talked about is through geoengineering schemes and technologies. And these include things like seeding clouds to increase the Earth's albedo, the Earth's reflective effect, so that more heat is reflected back into space, and seeding the oceans with iron so that more carbon is stored in seawater, and inventing nano machines that would pull carbon out of the atmosphere and turn it into plastics directly, and sucking carbon out of the atmosphere and putting it in deep geologic structures. These, you know, and even to even more fanciful things like huge arrays of panels orbiting the Earth, reflecting sunlight back out into space. It's really wild, some of the things that are being talked about. And there's a few different problems with these geoengineering proposals. One of them is that they're enormously expensive, in the many billions or even trillions of dollars. Another one is most of them rely on totally unproven technology. I mean, this is like cold nuclear fusion category speculation in a lot of cases. And the third one is that they don't address any other human problems. They're a way for some of the people who have gotten very wealthy off of our current crisis to continue getting very wealthy off of the solution for it. So the big thought behind carbon farming is that we already have the technology needed to accomplish that level of sequestration. And it's sequestration into ecosystems and land rather than into technological forms. And it's sequestration using trees and wetlands and soil and living things that people have been working with for all of human history, rather than requiring a cutting edge breakthrough. And also that carbon farming systems have the potential to address a lot of other human needs as well at the same time. Needs around food security, needs around other forms of climate security, like resilience from flooding, resilience from drought and heat waves, and just a lot of other things that come with more biodiversity and more intensified and diverse food production. So I'll pause there, but at a big picture level, that's what the carbon farming project is about. It's about doing large-scale biosequestration of carbon into agricultural landscapes.
Now, it's worth noting that one of the prime functions of a photosynthetic plant is to take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and turn it into a sugar and release oxygen. We love all parts of that as humans. Now, I think I've seen an example of this actually in action, and I think some of my more faithful listeners will remember this. Adam and I visited a place in Sebastopol, California a few years back called Singing Frogs Farm. And while there visiting, it's really just an amazing and productive farming operation. One of the things I noticed while they were talking was the number of bird species I could count. And I was up to 30, including night herons and really what I consider to be apex, very sensitive indicator species to say, wow, this place is healthy, Mm-hmm. And the place was grossing over $100,000 per acre, like seven times what the other farms were doing. And the owners, Elizabeth and Paul Kaiser, told us one of the facts that they had was that they'd increased their soil carbon percentage, or sequestration, in the, to use your term, from around 2% to a little over 8%. And then the shocking part was they said that if every farm in the world was doing this, the entire output of carbon dioxide from the beginning of the Industrial Revolution would be sopped up and put in the ground. And the place was, it was beautiful, it was vibrant, had this diversity of animal life, insects, to birds, everything. To me, this kind of represented the future of farming because it just felt right economically for starters, socially, because the people there, the farm was so healthy, the soil was so healthy, they could farm four crops a year instead of two or three, meant that they could work 40-hour weeks instead of cramming everybody into a really short agricultural season. And also ecologically, obviously, it felt really good. So to me, that was sort of a real life example of possibly what you're talking about. Is that a fair example?
Yeah, it is. And I want to say a few things about that. So, you hit on the two key places that carbon can be drawn down into on farmland. And one of them is building up carbon in soil. Mm-hmm. And that happens through the decomposition process, such as when we're composting. And also it happens through the exchange of sugars with soil microorganisms, mm-hmm. by plants. They're used in a form of commerce between plants and microorganisms, trading sugars for water and nutrients. And then also it can be stored in above ground sources of carbon. It can be stored in the wood and lignans and branches and root systems of perennial plants. So there's below ground carbon and above ground carbon. And that adds up to a more whole ecological picture of the carbon cycle in a terrestrial ecosystem. There's also a lot of carbon stored in wetlands, and there are some forms of wetland agriculture that can store carbon, but mostly we're talking about in soil and in perennial plants, especially trees and forests. In terms of the question of like how much carbon can be stored on farms globally, it's a hard one to calculate. And I don't want to make I feel quite comfortable making that big of a claim as those good folks made, simply because every farm is so different and every region and climate in the world is so different. There are very different sequestration potentials in different climates, in different soils, and in different types of farm production. So, however, I will say that that type of leap from a 2% soil organic matter to an 8% soil organic matter is definitely doable on millions of acres of farmland all around the world. And it's doable in, especially through diversified production and through carbon farming methods. So I believe that in terms of an order of magnitude kind of thing, that carbon farming can do the magnitude of sequestration that is needed to slow down and reverse climate change. But the greater challenge than the technological one is the social and financial and political work to make it happen. That's really where a lot of the obstacle is.
All right, well, let's get to that in a minute. So you just mentioned, you know, I was using a type of farming I think people can identify with, but it's vegetable farming. It's a very small niche of the overall agricultural type that's out there. So carbon farming, paint the picture for us. Can it be used in pastures? You mentioned wetlands, you mentioned trees or silviculture. Here we're mentioning vegetables. Can it be used in grains as well? Adam and I visited a farm in Maryland, 11,000 acre corn farm. They didn't have dirt. They didn't have soil anymore. They had dirt, and they were down at about 1.5% organic matter in there. I couldn't detect it with my nose at all. It literally smelled sterile, this red clayish soil that they had there. But they were a corn farm, so they're a grain operation. So amongst that sort of range of agricultural practices, what are we talking about here? Where does carbon farming fit and apply, and where might it have the most bang for the buck, so to say?
Yeah, so on a really simple level, what we're talking about is increasing organic topsoil on farms and increasing the amount of long-lived perennial plants on farms, especially trees. So there's ways to do both of those things in many different types of farming systems. So with annual production, growing annual grains, growing annual vegetables, there are soil management practices that involve the use of cover cropping, that involve the use of compost and manures, that involve crop rotation, and a variety of other things that have been well developed by the organic and sustainable farming movements over many years. Those things are carbon farming practices. They're storing a small amount of carbon per year, but they can be implemented across millions of acres because, you know, there's about 900 million acres of farmland in the United States, and almost 400 million of that is annual cropland, is tilled. So there's a lot of potential to improve the soil management practices on that acreage. And then there's also a lot of potential to incorporate trees into annual farming through techniques such as using windbreaks and using shelter belts that go through the landscape along waterways. And also things like alley cropping, where you're growing a tree crop alongside your annual crop. So you have a strip of trees, a strip of wheat or soybeans or corn, and then a strip of trees, and so on. And that's done on a pretty large scale in some parts of Missouri and some other parts of the US, and it's done on a very big scale in China. There's a system in China where they're growing jujubes, the Chinese date that some people might have tried, and they alley crop jujube with annual grains. And they're doing that on millions of acres in China now. There's whole technical manuals for it. So all that is to say that there's a lot of different ways to increase carbon storage on annual cropland. And the same is true on pasture and grazing land. So the management of animals on pastures, switching from a fixed paddock system where the animals have a single paddock they're in all year to a rotational system where the animals graze intensely in one area and then are moved relatively quickly, and then graze intensely and then are moved, and then graze intensely and then are moved. That's the type of grazing that grasses are adapted for evolutionarily in their coevolution with cows and buffalo and other grazing animals. And they respond really well to it. And the manuring of the animals, as well as the rest period that allows the grass to regrow, work together to store carbon through that rotational grazing. So that's at the level of how you manage the animal movements. And then there's the integration of trees into pastures in a practice called silvopasture, where you add a partial tree canopy to a pasture. So you're storing the above ground carbon in the trees, you're storing the below ground carbon from the tree roots and the rotational grazing. And then the animals have better health outcomes and better meat and milk production because they have access to shade year round.
Now, Connor, you just mentioned 800 million acres, half of that being in sort of annuals and vegetables, things like that. What's the math here involved? If we were storing, say, if we were going from, say, 2% to, say, 3% organic matter, we've got some practices, we're building that organic matter up in the soil. What's the math here? How much is that actually doing per acre? And then what would that mean if we applied that across all the acreage?
Yeah, great question. So 1%, I'm going to speak in acres here, but I will say that most of the international literature on this is in hectares and
metric
tons.
Which is 2.2 acres, right?
Yeah, which is somewhere between 2.2 and 2.5 acres. I don't remember on the top of my head, but you have to do a little bit of unit translation when you're working on things mm-hmm. from anywhere but the U.S. So a 1% increase in topsoil organic matter stores approximately 10 tons of carbon per acre. So that 6% increase that your friends on the West Coast achieved was storing 60 tons per acre, has stored about 60 tons of carbon per acre.
Right.
It's also worth noting that, as you said, pointing out the effects of all of that tillage, all of that fertilizer use, all that compaction and soil loss on that farm you saw in Maryland, the loss of soil carbon from farmland in North America is one of the global carbon bombs that has already gone off. Because those bottomlands, those tallgrass prairie landscapes in the Midwest, those rich river valleys in the East, those soils likely from some research and estimates and fragments that remain in some places, many of those soils had organic matter levels between 10 and 20% historically.
Wow.
And they're generally between 2 and 4% now or even lower. So, and this is a point worth making, that of all the surplus carbon that has been released since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, 300 years ago, the majority of it is still not from fossil fuel burning. The majority of the total accumulated surplus carbon is from land degradation. It's from deforestation, it's from tillage, it's from urbanization. And now it's a small majority, and fossil fuels are rapidly catching up, I have to say. But land degradation is a reversible process and beyond, right? Whereas the processes that make fossil fuels are not reversible in our lifetimes without technologies that we don't have yet.
Yeah, so let me see. So at 10 tons per percent for every 800 million acres, that's 8 billion, unless my math is really wrong.
Right.
So that would be that. That's just the United States. So, and you mentioned China's doing this, which is good to hear. But if we sort of apply this globally, we say, listen, if we were doing practices that we're building, just to take one example, building the organic matter in soil, this not even the stuff above ground, as you mentioned before,
yep.
The trees and the lignins, all that stuff there. But if we're doing that, these are fairly significant numbers that we're talking about. Again, we still have to find other means of reversing the flow of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. But this at least gives us a path to say, look, we can, while we're figuring that out, we can certainly be doing this to be storing this stuff in the ground. And oh, by the way, if polyface farms, which my listeners have heard about as well, with Joel Salatin, he took a relatively farmed out piece of land and without any material inputs through rotational grazing practices managed to bring it back to a very lush, deep topsoil, high organic matter kind of an operation, that if we're doing that, we're doing a number of things at once. First, we're rejuvenating the landscape. We're storing more water more effectively because they act like sponges. There's increased microbial interactions that can happen. So maybe we're increasing the nutrient density of our food, and we're generally repairing and restoring the land at the same time.
Yeah.
But we're also pulling carbon out of the atmosphere at this point in time. Is that a sort of a fair way to look at it?
Yeah, and I really want to highlight that carbon farming practices are not used just because of their carbon sequestration benefit.
Right.
They have very substantial co-benefits. And usually those co-benefits are actually the primary reason to do them. But from a policy and investment and social and public good point of view, we should be incentivizing the carbon side of it as well. And just to speak to your point about that total carbon storage potential is very high, and there's some important variables to that that I want to mention. So one of them is that there are many sites where much more than a 1% increase in organic matter is possible. There are some sites where it's also not possible because they're in highly arid regions where tillage farming isn't appropriate at all. There are also sites where trees are appropriate because of the climate, and there's other sites, again, especially in arid climates, where trees are not appropriate because they reduce water availability for other crops. So it's very place specific what the appropriate thing is to do. And another variable that's part of all this is that different carbon farming practices have different amounts of sequestration that are possible through them. So we have our 10 tons of carbon stored per 1% increase in organic matter. On the above ground side, a lot of the tree-based carbon farming systems are what's referred to as agroforestry. So they're trees integrated into farming in some way. And sometimes that's trees with annuals, trees with pasture, and sometimes it's just trees with trees. It's fully perennial systems, like a lot of tropical agriculture uses. And so the conversion of farmland with no trees on it to agroforestry, which doesn't mean necessarily changing the farming you're doing, it just means adding trees as alleys or windbreaks or buffers or in some form. Those systems can store between 50 to 100 tons of above ground carbon per acre. And some of the fully perennial systems, the multi-layer forest garden systems from the tropics that people are starting to learn how to do in cold climates too, some of those top out at around 150 tons stored per acre above ground. So there are some practices that are very high carbon storage per acre. And there's other practices that are lower carbon stored per acre, but we can do them on a lot more land. So adding it all up, the best numbers I've seen on the total theoretical storage potential worldwide both in above ground biomass and in below ground soil is between 300 and 350 billion tons. Now, that's good because at the present moment, we only have to take a little over a third of that out to get back down to 350 parts per million. But we're also still adding so much that in reality, we're going to have to take a lot more. And the other reality is that 100% adoption is not possible or realistic to set out as a goal, because there's whole parts of the Earth's surface that are experiencing war currently, that don't have functional governments, that there's been, you know, levels of social collapse and breakdown in which people improving their farming practices is not the survival priority. The survival priority is you know, safety from violence, water, food, you know, safe movement between areas. So 100% adoption is not going to be possible, but is 25% adoption possible? Is 40% adoption possible? 50%? I don't know, but I think that's the likely scale on which we have to be thinking in order to see a really meaningful contribution globally. And there are people working on this all over the world, especially in China, especially in parts of the tropics, and especially in a few European countries. France is probably doing the most in terms of European countries on carbon farming right now. And then there's starting to be work in the US on a bigger scale, primarily in California and a few Northeastern states, as well as there's quite some big work going on in the Midwest, in Illinois and Wisconsin and Minnesota, especially. The work of the Savannah Institute is of great interest around all of this. So that's kind of a global picture that I see, and happy to go wherever you want from here in terms of focusing on the interesting details that are going to be most relevant for your listeners.
Well, I really want to circle back to China because I'm intrigued by why they're being so forward thinking and aggressive in this way, if that's the right term, because they're really pushing in a lot of very fascinating ways. I'm always intrigued with what China is up to. But before we go there, I'm interested in how much of these practices are ready for prime time? Like, how much is experimental? How much have been done on a few you know smallish plots, 10 acres here and there? Like, what's really ready to come out and hit prime time? And I guess to get at that, we kind of have to understand what are the risks to the farmers. You mentioned before there are policy implications, and of course there's political dimensions to all of this. But yeah, if we're talking about at the individual incentive level, There's got to be, you know, the reason that the farmer in Maryland told me, he told me exactly how he could get back up to 6%. He just has to go fallow for 3 years. Could he afford that? Not on your life, right?
Right.
So there were clear risks to that. So I'm thinking about the implementation plan and what's ready for prime time, and how much of this is good ideas, but we still need more experimentation. What's ready to go? Where are we on this?
Yeah, great question. So it varies quite a bit, and it varies in different parts of the world. So in the tropics, we could convert from annual farming to fully perennial farming tomorrow with no loss of nutrition or calorie production, because the tropics have things like breadfruit and jackfruit and avocados and you know, date palms and oil palms and a thousand other staple tree crops that people have been growing for thousands, and in some cases people think tens of thousands of years, in deliberate agricultural settings. So the tropics are in a really interesting position to store large amounts of carbon through farm transitions. But that's one of the real risks here that needs to be talked about, is that what we're talking about is land improvements. That's what carbon farming represents. It's an investment in land and in the quality of land and the productivity of land. And those investments, they can't be made by people who are land insecure. Because if you don't have a reliable way to know that you're going to have access to your land 5, 7, 10, 15 years down the road, it doesn't make sense to invest in tree crops, and it doesn't make sense to invest in long-term soil building. It's not economically workable. And simultaneously, you know, agriculture is in such economic crisis globally, the margins are so thin for most people, that in many cases the farmer alone cannot shoulder the entire capital expenditure of these land improvements. Because although most carbon farming systems return to full profitability or even increase profitability on a 3, 5, 7, 10 year time frame, there often is a reduction in profitability for the first few years, just like changing any business practice and or any farming practice. Mm-hmm. So there's a real need for financing and technical assistance and support from a lot of different sectors towards these land transitions. And it's just important to be clear that there are some farmers who are taking it on wholly themselves, but a lot of this work has to be done on a bigger scale than a single farm. It has to be done through opening up funding and financing sources. It has to be done through opening up new markets that consumers are willing to pay for, and, you know, and also research and development money going into it. So, because often all it takes is one or a few farms to be successful for something, and then the rest of their farming region will follow. In terms of your very good question about readiness, there are some practices that are ready to go tomorrow on huge acreages. And so a lot of the improved annual production and improved grazing practices are like that. So, you know, cover cropping, there's a fully established science of cover cropping that's very developed in extension services and land grant universities all around the US. And there's been a big turn in interest towards cover cropping in conventional agriculture just in the last year and a half, 2 years. So a lot more acreage could be cover cropped, and that would make a big difference for a lot of reasons that we talked about earlier. Similarly, you know, the grazing practices can be adjusted and improved from fixed paddock grazing to rotational grazing with a little bit of infrastructure investment, with a little bit of technical support and training, and sometimes with changing markets to be, you know, fully grass-fed, holistically managed, you know, other marketing avenues that help the farmer tell the story of what they're doing. So that's a little bit of a bigger jump. And then a yet bigger jump is going from confinement feedlot operations to grass-based grazing operations. That's a big leap. And that's one that some farmers have made really successfully, but a lot of operations don't feel they can make because it requires a wholesale changing of how they're farming. On the above ground side, I guess I'll say one more thing there, which is there is a whole other realm of carbon farming practices which has to do with the research and development of new crops, and in particular, new perennial crops that are very carbon storing over their lifespans. So for instance, the Land Institute in Kansas is working on re-perennializing annual grains. So they're working on breeding and selecting perennial wheat, perennial rye, perennial barley, perennial beans, perennial corn, all of these staple foods, right? Because you know, we can grow fruits and vegetables all day, but at the end of the day, people need fats, proteins, and complex carbohydrates, starches, you know, to really fill out people's diets. So my big focus in carbon farming is on the production of those things more than the production of simple sugars and nutrients, because those things can be easily produced on small scales in locally interesting and beautiful and diverse ways all over the world. It's the staple crops that can be harder to figure out how to produce. So Land Institute is working on making new perennial staple crops. Badger Set Research Farm in Minnesota is working on breeding new perennial staple tree crops for cold climates. You know, improved hybrids of chestnuts and hazelnuts as things that could potentially replace corn and soybeans. But those breeding-based projects, especially the perennial grains and some of the staple crops that are used in the tropics, those are, you know, more experimental. They don't have a market established yet. The growing practices aren't fully ready yet. So we can't just put all our eggs in that experimental R&D basket. We have to also be improving the things that people are already using and buying every day.
All right, let me ask you about this then, because this is a big concern of mine, and the story starts here. There's nitrogen floating around in the atmosphere. It is pulled down. It's purified. Natural gas is used. They run a process called Haber-Bosch, and they create ammonia out of it. The ammonia goes into an Iowa farm. It's spread out, and it helps the corn grow, but some of it washes off into the Iowa River, which makes it to the Mississippi. It flows into the Gulf, and then we get something called a dead zone. And there are these dead zones in ocean areas all around large farming basins all around the world. And they're just really, they're hypoxic, meaning low in oxygen, low enough that it kills everything. But the anaerobic bacteria that love to live there on all this fat, tasty nutrition flowing down into their mouths, as it were. How does carbon farming begin to help us with that sort of a process? And I'll tell you why I'm really concerned about that. It's because the UN projects we're going to have to double food output by 2050, they think. And I'm not sure if I totally square around those numbers, but there will be a billion to a billion and a half more people. They will require more food, I assume. My research says that fossil fuels, such as the natural gas used to create the nitrogen, are going to be in decline by then. So to me, it's really from a self-interest, you know, we're an organism eating through a fossil fuel supply sort of a standpoint. That's a collision course. So I'm really interested in how this idea of carbon farming can begin to help us think about how we might be able to grow more efficiently, more effectively, maybe, you know, not squander nutrients by having them flow out to sea. Does it in any way begin to approach that dimension of the predicament we're in?
Yeah, absolutely. So those are all really good points and really good questions, you know, for the future of life for a lot of people in the world. And I want to make a distinction between export farming versus farming for regional use, because, you know, the so-called Green Revolution did succeed in certain ways at increasing crop yield, increasing production, and yet it came with a really complicated cost and complicated legacy, because not only was the genetically modified crops and new selected hybrids that the Green Revolution was selling, they were packaged with a suite of technologies that were very intensive on pesticide and herbicide use and very intensive on synthetic fertilizer use. And they were also packaged with a set of economic relationships that involved people in the global South growing for export markets rather than for the foods that they themselves ate. So the type of farming that you were describing that you saw on the West Coast, and I forget what state that was, and the more intensified and diversified type of farming that carbon farming often looks like, it's a type of farming that is more productive per unit area, more productive per acre in terms of total food production than large-scale commodity crop production is, but it may be lower production at the level of those commodity crops themselves. So I think the long-term future of agriculture is a lot more bioregional than what we're seeing right now, and partly it is because of that decline in the fossil fuel subsidy that we've been extracting that is coming in our future. And partly it's because of, you know, the nutrification and toxification of waterways and the ocean and other accumulating impacts of the amount of pesticide and herbicide and nitrogen fertilizer use that we're using. So yeah, these diversified farming systems, they do require fewer chemical fossil inputs taken as a whole than modern industrial farming does. And they also in some ways depend on that, because nitrogen fertilizers in particular, so not only do they have these big downstream effects on ecosystems, they also have a significant effect on the soil microbial community. So nitrogen fertilizer is one of the things that most quickly kills soil. It kills the bacterial communities and fungal communities that are who's doing the carbon sequestration in the soil, you know, when you don't have perennial plants doing it. So the part of the improvement in annual growing practices is about shifting away from nitrogen fertilizer use as the primary source of fertility and towards cover cropping and manures and composts as the source of that fertility. And then when you add in polycultural systems where you're integrating trees and annuals, where you have multiple different types of trees growing with each other, like in the tropics, a lot of these agroforestry systems give a substantial amount of their growing area to nitrogen fixing plants, because these plants that have that symbiosis with those soil microbes that can indeed take N2 molecules out of the air and turn them into ammonia directly, which is an ability that almost no other organisms in the world have. Nitrogen fixing plants are one of the big keys to ecological sources of fertilizer. And the other one is the use of animals, right? Because animal manures, both directly applied through grazing and indirectly applied through applying collected manure and composting, you know, those are another really big source of nitrogen. So it's going to require making farms that work more like ecosystems. They have an annual component, they have an annual component, they have a perennial component, and there's nutrient cycling within the farm and with the larger ecosystem and region. And I think that's part of how we're going to be able to intensify food production and keep feeding people, because, you know, the amount of food waste produced in the world right now, there's plenty of food being produced in the world right now, but it's not getting to the people who need it most because of economics and politics.
Absolutely. Very well said. And for my final question, you know, Connor, perhaps it's too early to say, but in Puerto Rico, where Hurricane Maria came, devastated 80% of the agricultural output for this year, besides maybe hopefully limiting the amount of heat content in the oceans in the future, how would carbon farming practices possibly have helped limit the damage or possibly speed recovery in Puerto Rico?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, so there's been some research on that exact question, actually, not with, of course, the hurricanes that have just happened, but with previous large storm events on tropical islands. And one of the things they've found is that, so there was one particular storm event, I don't remember which one it was, you'll have to forgive me, but there's one large storm event that took place. And the study was looking at the difference in crop losses between diversified farms and monocultures. And in that particular storm event, monocultures lost 80 to 90% of their crops from that one storm event, but diversified farms lost only 50% of their crops. And that's a big difference. And that's been visible in some of the large storm events in the mainland US as well. Places where there are wetland and riparian buffers, places where there's trees integrated into farms, places where people are not growing just a single crop for export, are places where people are faring better with extreme weather. And part of that is because of buffering of floods and winds, but part of it is also because they've got more baskets to put their eggs in. Some things are going to be really flattened by those storm events, and other things have more wind resilience. Some things have more flood resilience, some things have less. You know, it's like the old Andean traditional farmers who grow not just one variety of potato, but hundreds, because the different pests that come in each year never take out all of them. They just take out a few here and there. So this biodiversity is a really big part of it, and this structural diversity also, this having above ground complexity in hedgerows and windbreaks and trees and forest belts that go through the farming landscape and silvopastures that animals are grazing under, that adds up to, I think, a much more resilient landscape. So in Puerto Rico specifically, I don't know all the details down there. I haven't been there myself, but I do know that, you know, it's a humid tropical climate, and those have some of the most potential in the world to do these multi-layer farming systems where you have an overstory that's productive, you have a mid-canopy that's productive, you have an understory growing cacao or coffee, and then you have enough animals and nitrogen fixers to make it all work. So I think that that's, you know, that's some of what is going to really help. And the other thing I'll say is that the role of mangrove forests and other coastal, natural coastal ecosystems is really significant for storm resilience, because a lot of those coastal landscapes, dune grass systems, mangroves, a lot of different things around the world, but they buffer some of the impacts of those storms. And when those are cut down for either agriculture or tourism or fossil fuel refining, or in some cases, aquaculture, right? So a lot of the shrimp that's eaten in the wealthy global north comes from aquaculture, in saltwater aquaculture in Southeast Asia, where they've been clearing mangrove forests in order to produce that shrimp. And that is a big reduction in their resilience to cyclones and other large storms in their part of the world. So we really have to think about how all these parts of a whole region fit together and where some of our sources of resilience are. And it might mean, you know, growing different things, buying different things, and planting different things in some cases. But I think people are trying it and working on it and learning things that are unique to each place. So that, you know, if I was leaving people with one bigger thought, it's that you have to get to know your place in order to know what's most appropriate and workable, what's most regenerative, and what the carbon farming pathway is going to look like in your place. It's not going to be the same in Kansas as it is in Florida, as it is in Uzbekistan. You know, each place has its own particularity and appropriateness. And so that's one of the really exciting things about this field and this project, is that there is a global knowledge base being assembled that is highly diverse, that reflects the diversity of our world.
Indeed. And I would suggest, if you have the opportunity, just get out of your car, go visit the farm or the place that's doing the agriculture, and it will be obvious. It will just seem healthier and more diverse and clearly functioning, which has been my impression of every place I visited that seems to be running these integrative practices where there's a variety of things going on. You won't just see a field of canola, you know, you'll see something different than that. So I lied. I guess I have to circle back for one last question. You mentioned China is really on board. Seemingly they're running practices like this on millions of acres. Why is that, do you think?
Gosh, that's a good question. Well, you know, China's one of those countries that I think a lot of people who've never been there have a lot of thoughts and theories and ideas about, and I have never been there, so I really can't presume to say much about it. But it does look from the outside like China is taking climate change seriously in a way that the U.S., for instance, has not to date. And that's showing up in renewable energy, that's showing up in transportation, and it's showing up in agriculture. I think also, there's something, like for instance, both South Korea and North Korea are also doing a lot of carbon farming and have some really impressive knowledge bases and, you know, beautiful technical manuals for how to do agroforestry on steeply sloping land and how to do polycultures with tree fruits and nuts and animals. It's really amazing. And I don't know, it might have something to do with the long history of peoples in that region and the fact that a lot of different farming has been done there over many thousands of years. And I think in North America, our history of more recent colonization by European people, there was this image of like, this land is ours for the taking, which of course was done through genocide and slavery and a lot of other really harmful things. But there was something about, we don't have to conserve these resources because there's so much of them. And it's really tragic, the outcomes of that in a lot of places, because that resource base was exhausted really fast. And I think you can see that in Australia too, with the colonization by English people. So I think there's something to learn from these places where people have lived in one place for a very long time. And, you know, a lot of the places in the world that are doing the most carbon farming also are in the global tropics, in the global south, in tropical climates, where traditional agroforestry is continuing largely uninterrupted in a lot of places. There's a lot to learn from those traditional societies and traditional food production systems. And that's true even in places where that knowledge might appear lost or missing or gone from the landscape. It's often not as gone, lost, and missing as it might look like. Might have to talk to some old timers. Might have to do some research. Might have to look at places down the road that are similar, or places in other parts of the world, you know, where the, you know, with migrations of people. But I think there's a lot more knowledge that has survived than it can appear at first glance. But we have to learn a lot to do this well.
I'll add one last thing on China. I've only been there once, but so no expert here. And the UN panel that I'm serving on has a couple of very highly placed people from China. And one of them, when we were talking over lunch, I was asking him about you know, very highly qualified, a scientist, a doctor, was talking about the political climate in China and who rises to power. And he just winked and said, well, we don't have any community organizers at the top, because Obama was president at the time. And what he was saying was that where the United States is really parked with at the top with a lot of lawyers, which is a specialty, breeds a way of thinking, but we don't have a lot of scientists and engineers at the top, as it were. And China has a different, and Taiwan very differently organized. They revere the hard sciences and science practices and things like that. So I think that China's actually got some highly qualified people who are capable of understanding systems thinking and really looking at the data, understanding where we're at, not saying it's a perfect system by any means, which one is. But I am saying that I think they've got people there who get it, and certainly their acquisitive practices around resources tell me that they understand the world is not infinite. So it just seems they're playing a different game. So I'm always intrigued, and my eyebrows always go up another millimeter when I'm trying to find out what China's up to. You just saw recently, you know, they're mandating electric cars in a lot of city areas for pollution, right, but for other reasons. They've got the largest annual budget for alternative energy. They've decided to become number one in wind and solar power. They're working on thorium reactors. They're just doing everything that would align with this view of the idea that fossil fuels are limited and we need to get off of them for a variety of reasons, including it's going to happen anyway.
Right.
So why not do it on our terms instead of some other terms? And so that's why I'm always intrigued by what they seem to be doing. So it's great to hear that they're already experimenting with and putting in practice some of these things that you've been talking about.
Yeah, and just another example of that, you know, this work on perennial grains, you know, which has made big progress in the U.S. There's kernza of wheat that's now starting to be available on the market for baking and brewing and other things. Mm. But so in China, they have perennial rice. And rice is a huge staple crop for people all over the world. And there are tens of thousands of acres that have been planted in perennial rice just in the last 2 years in China.
Wow.
And you know, and they're doing it in, you know, the warmer subtropical parts in the south of the country. It's not as readily applicable to a lot of parts of the U.S. There's not a lot of rice production in the U.S. But just as an example of, you know, there's a lot going on in the world beyond what's going on in the U.S. And it's been really useful and rich to, you know, those of us who are in the U.S. working on carbon farming to engage with that larger global story and larger global picture. Because we can get a little myopic in the U.S. about our own sphere, but there's so much to learn from other parts of the world.
Of course.
You know, speaking of things to learn, I just want to point out a few resources to your folks around where to learn more about this whole topic. So probably the best single resource that's been assembled so far on the carbon farming topic specifically is a book written by my good friend and colleague, Eric Tonesmeyer, also a resident of Western Massachusetts, who published the book The Carbon Farming Solution about a year ago in 2016. It looks like a textbook. It's a little bit easier to read than a textbook. It is a big resource, but it has the most in one place that I've seen anywhere about this topic, and has a really big global view like we've been talking about. It has a lot of information, especially about the very high carbon sequestering systems. Also really cool stuff in it about perennial industrial crops, which we didn't talk about here, but you know, perennial bioplastics, perennial oil production that can be used to phase out fossil fuel-based plastics, and other products that our world run on. There's one estimate that 70% of the non-fuel petroleum products used in the world could be replaced with products from perennial plants with enough breeding and enough plant out of those systems. That's pretty cool. And some of those perennial industrial crops have some of the highest carbon sequestration potential also. So there's a lot in the book, The Carbon Farming Solution. The other one I want to mention is the work of Project Drawdown, which was Paul Hawken is the editor of that book, but it was done by a team of hundreds of researchers from all over the world. And it's assembling what are the climate change, climate mitigation solutions that are already being used all around the world and calculating their emissions reduction effects, their carbon sequestration effects, and their economic costs and economic output potentials. So it's a really, really interesting snapshot, and it's so useful because the climate change conversation can seem so abstract sometimes when mm-hmm. we're talking about solutions, but Drawdown has the top 50 of them laid out with photographs and numbers and research references to where the numbers came from and how they were calculated. And it just lays it all out. Like, here's the best stuff that's been figured out all over the world so far, and here's what people are actually doing with it already. And it really drives home that message that we don't need massive new technological breakthroughs to resolve this challenge. That some of those might be great, but really the technologies we need are already in use, and they just have to be amplified and invested in and adopted.
I love that message. Yes, we already, like, there are things not only that we can be doing, but we should be doing, because they're already here and they work.
Right.
And they make sense on all these dimensions. And to cycle back, we're only doing them because we're holding the wrong beliefs. Like, oh, I don't know, we don't have to worry about this. The, you know, we just conquered this land. It's infinite. You know?
Right.
So if we can shift those beliefs, lots of things, and they make sense. They make economic sense. They make ecologic sense, social sense, you name it.
Yeah. So check out that book Drawdown as well. Drawdown. That just came out in the last few months. It's a really big contribution to this conversation all around the world.
Fantastic. Well, Connor, thank you so much for your time today. If anyone's interested in finding out more about your work or the services you offer or that are offered by Appleseed Permaculture, where should they go to find out more or to contact you?
Sure. So Appleseed Permaculture is a design and consulting firm, and we work with farmers and institutions and communities on implementing carbon farming practices and implementing climate adaptation projects, especially at the level of land use, especially involved with farming and forestry and land management. So you can find us online at appleseedpermaculture.com, and you can send us a message at design@appleseedpermaculture.com if you want to learn more and talk more about it.
Fantastic. Well, Connor, thanks again. Really appreciate your message and the work you're doing.
Thanks so much, Chris. Real pleasure to chat with you. Look forward to more.